Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/turniton and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/turniton.
This is Turn It On.
Listen to me, it's Arnold. You're listening to Turn It On with Michael J.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 55 of Turn It On. My name is Michael J., and this is my podcast. We are coming to you, as always, from beautiful Nashville, Tennessee, the center of the musical universe. My good friend Gaurav Bali is on the show today, and you're going to hear our talk in just a few minutes. Before we get to that, though, we've got some new things going on here at Turn It On. We have a newly designed website at tiopod.com with some brand new items in our merch store. You can get t-shirts for men and women in all sizes. There are pull-down menus to mix and match shirt and logo colors, and there's a really big selection there. We also have two different coffee mug designs as well as hats and hoodies. You can also buy my latest two records and my last EP directly from me in the store, so I encourage you to do that. Do me a favor, head on over there, check it out. And we're trying out a new company called Dizzy Jam for these things to see how they work out. So if you end up ordering merch for any reason and you're not satisfied, or if you're extra satisfied with things, if they show up, they fit really well, they look really cool, drop me a line at either mj@tiopod.com or the contact page at tiopod.com and just let me know how we're doing. Hey, everybody. This show is a labor of love for me, and I've always worked very hard to deliver meaningful content of only the highest quality for you. My advertising budget at the moment is $0.00, and in the current climate of podcasting, it's getting harder and harder for independent shows like mine to get noticed, and even harder to attract sponsors to monetize things so I can start possibly making a living doing this thing, or at the very least, supplementing my income so that my time isn't quite as stretched when I'm trying to put the shows together. This is where I ask you to do me a favor. If you're a listener of the show and you've enjoyed it, please subscribe to the feed on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and also take a quick minute to leave me a review on iTunes. This not only helps with ratings, but it also helps other people find the show. I'm sure there's an absolutely huge audience for this thing that's just waiting to discover it, but I can't get there without your help. I've also set up a Patreon page at patreon.com/turniton. That is patreon.com/turniton. And I've only set up a single pledge tier, which is just $1. You can definitely give me more, and that would be amazingly awesome. But if a few hundred of you pledge at $1 or even $2 a month, it'll start to lighten the load a little bit. And there will be no rewards for those pledges on Patreon at the moment, but if the response is good enough, I'll be able to start generating bonus content for people who pledge, and we'll kind of see where it goes from there. And the last thing you can do to help out is to tell your friends about the show. Word of mouth is always the best advertisement, so start talking about it, posting about it, sharing it to your social media pages, and all that kind of stuff. And hopefully, with a small amount of effort on your part, we can start growing the audience for this thing, and I can keep doing it. Thank you all so much for sticking with me here, and thank you all in advance.
This is Jim from the Ivans, and now back to Turn It On.
Okay, my friend Gaurav Bali is my guest on today's show. I've been friends with Gaurav for a few years now, and as you'll hear in our talk, I actually played a very small part in convincing him to move to Nashville back when he was visiting and trying to make a decision. He's an amazing guitarist and a really sweet and funny guy, and we had a really great chat. So, without further ado, this is me and my friend Gaurav Bali. Nyx has been trying to get me to buy a houseboat.
Please do that. See, I want to come to this housewarming sale.
He's like, dude, just think about it, man. Because a friend of a friend of his has this apparently like brand new houseboat for sale that's been for sale for a couple of years now. They just like he got the hull or whatever you call that. Is the hull? I don't know what the fuck it is.
You can't tell by looking at me, but. I'm not. I know I look like a maritime expert, but I look like I know my way around the sea. I know.
You look like, you look, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, Indian people are natural sailors, I mean.
But he's like, yeah, dude, like the guy got this, got the hull and like, and then gutted it and then rebuilt the houseboat on top of it. And he said, it's like super nice. He's like, it's the size of a small apartment. Right. And I don't even know what he's asking for it. But Chris is just like, he's been on me incessantly for like the last however long that I need to, he's like, you need to buy this houseboat. And then he's like, and then you can have everybody, everybody refer to you as Captain J. And make sure, like, have captain's hats that I pass out.
Well, like, that's a given. I mean,
when you come to the boat, you have to wear the captain's hat. And as soon as you step on the boat, you have to refer to me as Captain J.
Nice. You have to dress in all white.
Yeah, bring your dress whites.
You know what? I'm super curious how much something like that is. Like to buy or rent or whatever.
I want to say it's really reasonable. It's not a lot of money. And okay, Chris
so
is like,
you're really buying.
Chris is just so funny. He's like, why live the usual life, man? Live the unusual life, buy the boat. And I'm like, you know, I'm half thinking about it. I'm kind of half like, okay, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good point, but do we get storms bad enough here to
no,
like,
I mean, it's on the lake. I mean, it's not, you know, right, or it's on the ocean. It's not,
oh, right,
like,
right, okay.
But if I want to, but
it shows you how much of a maritime expert I am. I'm like, what about hurricanes? You're like, dude, it's a lake.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there you go.
And he's like, if you want to move it, then you just, you know, you can move it to an ocean. You could go, and he's like, no matter what, he's like, even if you end up buying a house after that, then you've still got a boat. And I'm like, oh, okay. He's making more sense every time. And I don't know what his, he's got to have some kind of ulterior motive. Well, like he just wants to come and hang on the boat.
Yeah, of course.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a houseboat though. You're not going to be going sailing on that thing.
What's the difference between a houseboat and like, so you're saying it's not very,
I mean, it's
sporty?
It's probably seaworthy, but I don't think you'd want to take it to sea. Right. Like it's a houseboat, you know, meant to be like parked up against a dock somewhere, which I'm like, you know, he's like, yeah, you can drive it around, go whatever. I'm like, I've never driven a boat in my life. Like I'd be the guy that crashed that fucking thing into the dock and like destroy it, you know, or destroy other people's property.
Can you like lay out and sunbathe or something on it to chill? I mean, not that I would, obviously. I would look like a raisin if I did that, but
why would you not be able to lay out? Not, and
I don't know. I don't know what the layout is.
No, it's got...
Is it just, like, literally a shoebox on the water?
It's got, like, a patio in the back with furniture and an upper deck with patio furniture and all that kind of stuff. So it's, like, it's... I mean, I haven't seen it. We almost went and saw it yesterday, but I wasn't...
Oh, okay.
I wasn't kind of like, okay, I don't know. I'm not sure if I want to see it, because then if I want to see it... I'd like having my own place, but I can't beat the rent where I'm at right now.
Yeah, we've had this conversation because if you remember, even like last year, I said, you know, you guys don't have any rooms, right?
Yeah, right.
Because every year it's the same thing. It's like the, you know, as you can see by this place, like there's nothing super wrong with it per se.
No,
but it's old. You know, it was built in the 70s, so the parking is an issue because when it was built in the 70s, every family basically had one car.
Right.
Like when I got home, you know, last night or this morning at 2:30, it's like, you know, I had to park in Timbuktu over there. You know,
oh, so parking over.
Parking is an issue. Also, if you were to go, please don't, but if you were to go into my kitchen or my bathroom, like the drawers and the cabinets are like the 70s style, like no handles, just like white paint. And they're like falling off the hinges. They gave me new carpeting. They repainted. They gave me a new sink. They redid my shower. But the drawers and the cabinets are still 70s style. So like paint, you know, like with the paint, white paint dripping.
Oh yeah, right.
It looks like that. And my shower is so thin that, you know, when I shampoo my hair, like, you know, my elbow's like, poof, you know, like it's hitting the side.
Oh,
like,
so it's a small tub.
And I was, if I was showering, you would just hear, ah, fuck, god damn it. You know, that's what you would hear. And then, you know, I'm not complaining. It's, the neighborhood's decent. It's in between Brentwood and Antioch. Uh-huh. So, I've been given the okay by the locals to say it's, I can say Nipper's Corner.
Can you say Braniac?
No, that's what I don't want to say.
You can't say Braniac.
Because Antioch is in there. And I'm too fancy for that, as you know. I'm way too sophisticated. So since my Starbucks is three blocks that way and it's Nipper's Corner, the locals have told me that I can claim Nipper's Corner.
You can claim Nipper's Corner as your address. Okay.
So, you know, right there on the corner is Nolensville. Yeah. And then it turns into
Blue. Maybe we should just give your address out and just tell everybody where you live to come visit.
Yeah, please. I mean, like,
come shower at Gara's place.
Yeah, it's very comfortable. But you're one of the few people that come here, because the other thing you might have noticed is that I'm a little lacking in the home entertainment department. I've never owned a TV.
Yeah.
I don't have cable. Because
we talked about this.
Yeah, we did. Because
that you don't know movie quotes because you don't see movies.
Well, that's because I don't go to the movie theater a lot. Up until I went to go see the Queen movie with my my 30 Vice bandmates. Up until then, we did talk about this too. The last movie I had seen in the theater before that was when we went to go see what was that movie?
Oh shit! That's a long time ago.
Like 2 months after I moved to town. What was
it? It wasn't a Star Wars
Deadpool.
Movie. Oh, Deadpool.
Yeah.
Right.
We saw the first Deadpool
That's
together.
Right.
And before Bohemian Rhapsody, that was the last time I'd been to a movie theater. I think that was February.
Deadpool was like 4 years ago.
Yeah. I think that was February or so of 2016.
Yeah.
So maybe like 2 months after I moved to town, like right when we all became friends.
Do you just not like movies or do you?
No, I love movies, but I'm, you know, as far as new movies, I don't know. And the other thing is that since I don't own a TV, I never know what the hell is out. So, like, after a movie comes out, I look at Facebook and everyone's like, what everyone think of the new whatever movie? And I'm like, I have no idea.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're online, right? So, you know.
Or like, for example, you know, Game of Thrones and all that. You know, the whole thing is, you know, for a month, I was thinking to myself, what the hell is GOT?
I guess
there's this really cool show called GOT. I gotta check it out. I go on Netflix. I'm like typing in search GOT. I'm like, what's this show GOT? And then started posting and I'm like, oh, Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
So as I know now, you guys have been enjoying almost a decade of the show.
10 years,
and I've yet to see one episode. And at this point, it's not even worth it. Yeah, I mean, someone like you that I know loves the show would say you should start watching it. But again, it's like, I love TV so much that if I had, let's put it this way. I lose enough hours in the day just on Netflix and on, because as you know also, I still love my cheesy network crime shows.
Clunk, clunk.
Yeah, exactly.
I should put that sound
Sexually
effect.
Based defenses are the most famous.
I'm gonna use that throughout this whole. I'm gonna have that in this whole podcast as transitions. It'll be the.
Yeah.
Please do. No, I'm going to.
Oh yeah. So I'm a total.
It's a done thing.
Law and Order, SVU guy, Criminal Minds, NCIS. There's always a new cool show.
Like crime procedurals.
Yeah, and I'm constantly pissed off every September because every new show that I like gets canceled because I'm the only one apparently that's been watching it. I'm like, but I don't know who killed the guy now. Right. Like, they just end the show and I'm like, great.
Yeah, right.
Now I have no idea who the killer
was. Well, that's why you got to stick with something like Game of Thrones that's gone for a decade and they had a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah, no, I know.
People were pissed off about the end, but.
No, I know, as I saw.
Yeah.
But, you know, so between just the Netflix, the movies, you know, their originals.
Right.
And then, of course, you know, my late night when there's nothing else on, I'll just start watching like NCIS from season one because it's so old that you forgot.
That you forgot what happened. Yeah,
forgot what happened. So they're new to you.
you just watch them again.
Every once in a while, you recognize one and be like, next.
Yeah.
One of the main things that we all do is we're constantly learning new songs for something or another.
Yeah.
You know, the pop band that I play in 30 Vice, we're always learning new songs to make the show better or they put together all these really cool medleys and stuff.
Sure.
You know, it takes a good amount of time to learn, you know, 8 minutes of something, even if you're making charts and stuff that. And then, you know, if we play at a wedding or something, you know, there's like the first dance songs and all that. So, you know, or a new artist calls you out of the blue, hey, can you do this one off 10 more songs? So when you're constantly doing that, to have a TV and cable, like I said, it's dangerous enough with this.
Let's go back to how we met. Cause like, I remember you coming into the MIPS show at the Sutler. Was it the Sutler, right?
It was.
And you hadn't moved here yet.
I hadn't. I'll do the abridged version.
Sure.
Patient Zero is our mutual friend, Señor Luis Espaillat.
Oh yes, right. Patient Zero. Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
He's to blame.
Oh, he's to blame for it. Okay.
Yeah. I was in a band for about 15 years from New York. That Luis, we ended up hiring him to play bass for a couple of years.
Okay. Was that Hot Action Cop or was that?
No, that was Luis's band.
Oh, that was Luis's band.
Yeah, that was Luis's band.
I wasn't sure if you were in that band with him or not.
No. Luis was in my band from New York called Eve to Adam.
Oh, Eve to Adam, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we hired him to play for a couple of years and then he left at the beginning of 2014. I left at the end. And then my plan was I was, you know, kind of done with being in a band.
Yeah.
You know, so like I cut my hair and my plan was that, you know, I'm going to stay in New York.
and I'm going to teach guitar and, you know, do whatever else in music.
You're from New Jersey originally.
Yeah, I grew up in northern New Jersey. My dad worked in the city. He was a bridge and tunnel guy. And so from like September of 14 to 15, mm-hmm. I was home trying to get this teaching business off the ground. I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
Did the typical like advertising, this and that. Got nowhere. And my parents had sold their bigger house mm-hmm. that I had a project studio in the basement.
Okay.
And they moved into a 3-bedroom. So I'm in my late 30s and I'm living with my folks in a 3-bedroom apartment. Now, they're great.
Yeah. Yeah.
But... you know, it's still your parents. So, and you know, sadly, they didn't crap my style.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. In fact, my mom would walk in sometimes on a Saturday and be like, "Don't you have any friends?" I'm like, "Nope, I lost all my friends in New York from all the touring and traveling." So I was in like a really bad place. So I end up, you know, Luis gives me a call.
Right.
At the end of September.
Yeah.
And the reason I know it so specifically shall be revealed momentarily. Mm-hmm. He called me at the end of September and he was like, "Hey, man, you don't sound so good." I was like, yeah, well, I'm trying to figure out, you know, whether I should jump out of my window or slash my wrist, basically, you know?
Yeah.
And he was like, whoa, what, you know, what's going on? And I, you know, I told him, I'm like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
You know, I've been home for a year and right. I literally don't have a student. I have no musical prospects. I realized that, you know, when you tour for 15 years, basically you lose all your friends where you're from and you make friends all over the country that you see when you travel.
Right.
So... he was like, "Well, you ever think of, you know, moving to uh-huh. Nashville?" And I was like, "Yeah, that's funny. Seriously, so I don't, you know." And he's like, "No, I'm serious.
Yeah,
you know,
you should
consider it.
Right.
You know, the scene's growing. There's a lot of great people here. You know, this and that." And I was like, "Yeah, I don't know, man." And we had, you know, the funny part is that, of course, I had been here. You know, the tour that you know that Luis did the first time he did with us was when we were opening for Creed. So we had done the Ryman, you know, Exit In. We, you know, I'd been to Nashville a few times, and you know, all I knew of it was just what every other band knows right. when they come through. Oh, cool! Yeah, it's fun to go to Broadway. That's where the bars are. That's
yeah,
it. That's
right.
all
okay.
I knew of it. So anyway, during the course of this conversation, he was like, "Well, why don't you come down and check it out?" So my friend who we were talking about before that, you know, had the 3-bedroom down the street here.
Yeah.
I was talking to her because she'd recently moved to town and she said, "Well, you know, why don't you, I think it's a great idea. You know, why don't you come down? You can stay in my 3rd bedroom for like a month
sure.
for free.
Yeah.
Check out the city. And if you decide to move here, then you can rent the room if you want.
Yeah.
And if not, get your own place. No strings."
Okay.
You know, so she was wonderful to do that.
Right.
So, you know, I tell Luis this. And he was like, "This sounds great. This is perfect. You know, when are you thinking of coming?" So this is like the end of September, like mm-hmm. I said. So I was like, "Yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, you know, my cousin's birthday party is on the..." And he's like, No. "If you seriously want to do this, you need to come..." Like, this was a Thursday or Friday we were talking. He was like, "You need to come Sunday." And I was like, "What's the emergency?" And he was like, "Well, because Mondays and Tuesdays are a great 2 days for me to introduce you to a lot of people." And I said, "Why is that?" And he's like, "Well, on Mondays, there's this thing that my friend Tom Hurst and mm-hmm. Chris Nix do called Loud Jams."
Right.
"And on Tuesday, there's this other thing that some other friends do called MIPS, where they play covers. And right. everyone,
yeah,
you know, everyone's going to be there. So I can introduce you to a lot of great people that day." So I was like, "All right, well, if I'm going to do it, I might as well, you know, it's not like I have anything keeping me here." So within that Friday, mm-hmm. I literally like packed up some gear, some clothes, and I drove
right
straight through that Sunday. Literally that Monday, it was the October 2015 Loud Jams.
Wow.
Was the night that I met Chris.
Yep.
Our mutual buddy, Chris Nix.
Yep.
So I got into town Sunday. Monday, I texted Luis. I was like, "All right, I'm here. What are we doing?" And he's like, "Okay, well, you're going to meet me at 7:30 at this place called Douglas Corner."
Mm-hmm.
This is how far back we're talking.
Yeah, right. Douglas Corner. Yeah.
So I was like, "Okay." I put it on my GPS. I show up and there's Chris Nix. There's Yvonne mm-hmm. Smith. There's Michael J. There's all
everybody,
these people,
yeah.
you know. So he just starts making the rounds, introducing me to everybody. You know, I watched the show and I was like, you know, a combination of inspired and intimidated, as I'm sure you were.
Absolutely.
Because
yeah.
I was like, "Wow, this would be amazing to live here, but I stink."
I think anybody that says yeah. different is lying. Because, I mean, you come here and there's just
yeah,
like...
Yeah, I mean, let's put it this way. I walked into the place and it was like Nix and Tom and Tony Nagy playing Shy Boy by David Lee Roth.
Right, yeah.
And I was like...
That'll...
hmm.
Yep.
So I could move here, but this guy already lives here. So what am I going to do here? You know, it was one of those things. Okay, so I didn't meet you that night. So then that Tuesday,
the next night,
he said, okay, now the second night, there's this place called the Sutler. Come right there. And that's when, that's the night that
yeah.
Chris was there too. And he introduced me to you.
I remember,
Luis
yeah.
was there. And then yep. there was a whole, because as you know, there's kind of, there's some cross-pollinization
mm-hmm.
of kind of crowds, if you want to put
sure.
it that way.
Yeah.
I don't want to use the word cliques, but crowds.
Yeah.
So it
yeah,
was like, you know, it was one group on Monday and then some people from Monday, but then a whole different group too. So Tuesday was like you, Tripper Ryder, Justin Butler, right. Chelsea Bain,
yep.
Sarah, yep. you know, Tripper's now wife, right. at that time girlfriend. Yeah, yeah. So it was a whole new group of people. Yeah. And that's the first time I met you guys. That's yeah. the night that you actually were like, you know, I think you should do it, man.
Yeah. No, I remember giving you the spiel because I think I'd been here. It was 2015. When the fuck did I move? I think I'd been here a couple years.
Yeah.
How long have you been here now?
It's been 3.5 years.
So 3.5 years. So yeah. I've been here about 3 years then. Cause I'm like 6.5 now. Six,
right.
almost
so you've
7 years.
Been, yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, I remember, one thing that you said that stuck with me was you said, everyone is like-minded here.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I was like, all right, that makes sense. Because, well, I mean, the main thing you said was like, I know it seems intimidating because everywhere you go, and of course, like I said, the first two nights, I'm watching Knicks play the first night and everybody else. And then yeah. the next night I'm watching Justin Butler play.
Right.
And, yeah. you know, all these people. And I'm sitting there going like, what kind of work could I possibly get here if these guys are in town? And this
sure.
is just the first two nights.
Yeah.
You know, this is just Luis's friends.
Right. You
know?
Yeah.
So, but you said, you know, yeah, but that's true. But at the same time, you know, no one really looks at it here like it's a competition. Everyone right. is down to help each other out and they just look at it as a community and kind of what goes around comes around. Mm-hmm. And if you help this person, if they can help you in the future, they'll help you. And that way everyone's taken care of. Which is the exact opposite of mentality of New York and LA. Which is why now we know 3 years later, because half the population of New York and LA are in Nashville.
Are here now, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So that
yeah.
that statement you made 3.5 years ago mm-hmm. on that fateful evening at the Sutler
yeah.
Was proven to be true. That was the first two nights, and then I just spent the rest of October hanging, you know, Chris and I became friends immediately. You yep. and I started hanging
yep.
out.
Yep.
Luis obviously was showing me around and whatever, around his schedule. And then I started meeting new people and hanging out and,
sure.
you know, just at the end of, that month, you know, the November Loud Jams was coming up
mm-hmm.
and Chris, you know, who, you know, puts together the guitar players, you know, or still was at that time.
Right.
Said, you know, hey, there's, you know, there's a couple of songs left. Why don't, you know, when are you going home? You know, why don't you do a couple of songs?
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, really? Would you do that? And he was like, yeah, man. So he was gracious enough to let me do two songs, during the Loud Jam show. And then, you know, at the end of the night, you know, it was one of those like, so what am I going to do? Move back now and never see these people again? No.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so then, yeah. you know, Chris was like, you know, he kind of gave me the, so what's the, you know,
right.
what's,
yeah.
What's the verdict?
What's the verdict?
What's
right.
the verdict? You know? And I was like, all right, I guess I'm moving here, you know? And he was, you know, so he was like, great. That's awesome. So literally the night after that Loud Jams, I flew back home to New York.
Yeah.
Stayed home for a week, packed up the second half of my stuff and drove it down. And then I started renting the room at the friend who I mentioned right. before down the street. And I did that for the first few months. Then in, you know, and I was doing the typical stuff that everyone does. You know, I was driving Lyft.
Yeah.
I had some money, you know, a little bit of money saved up or whatever. And then in March of 2016, a month after we saw Deadpool, which was, I think, my second time in a movie theater in the millennium, Chris called
yeah,
me
yeah.
and he was like, hey, you know, do you want to sub? I play with this artist, Chuck Wicks. Do mm-hmm. you want to sub in for the summer? And
right.
Michael's the other, you know,
right.
the other guitar player and,
yeah.
and background vocalist. And I was like, well, what's the, you know, what's the audition going to be this and that? And he goes,
you're in.
There's no audition. If you want to do it, you're going to do it. I was like, all right, of course. Thanks.
Sure.
And so that's when, you know, you and I had the opportunity to, you know, become,
to play together,
to play
bit,
together
yeah.
and travel and, you know,
yeah.
That's
some fun.
We had a blast. The fateful, my first Nashville show was,
should we tell a story about
Country
that?
Jam in Jacksonville opening for Rascal Flatts.
Was that,
yeah,
was
it, was,
okay?
it was me, you, Rob Mitchell, Jeff Lockerman.
Oh, so we should tell the story, or you should help tell the story for
yeah,
sure,
yeah,
because
for sure.
it's not, and I don't want to, this isn't disparaging in any way against anybody.
No, because no, no. This is a touching fish out of water story. Me being the fish and country thunder or whatever it was called, yeah, being the water.
Well, you'd only really played rock stuff before that, kind
yeah,
of,
so
right?
I'm, so I moved to town with I'm lucky enough to be an EVH Fender artist. EVH sure. being Eddie Van Halen's company through
yeah,
Fender.
Sure.
So I was used to using 120 watt heads with two 412 cabinets. You know, slight guitar nerd talk, but not really.
People will understand.
Loud. Like something you would use at a theater or an arena, basically, or way too loud at a club. So I moved down with this stuff, and immediately, you know, Nick starts laughing at me. He's like, I love this just as much as you do, but this ain't gonna fly. If you show up with this, it's instant. You might as well get douchebag tattooed on your forehead. So I was like, okay, so you guys had started helping me to kind of redo my gear and this and that. So basically, okay, so where would you start the story?
Well, I would start it with, I was asked to do a bunch of stuff too, because Chris normally is in the capacity of, like, he generally tour manages and handles all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And
he still was.
And still was. Deals with logistics and all that kind of thing. And he plays lead guitar. And so I've actually subbed in for him on this gig as well, where we've had another guy take my spot. So I had to relearn the songs that I already knew, but from the other guitar player's point of view, which was helpful.
Which you told me.
You came in to play lead, and Chuck was going to fly.
Yes, I remember.
And I was going to drive. I was offered extra money to drive, to get up super at the butt crack of dawn and drive the van with the band and the trailer full of shit.
Yes.
To Florida. So we get there. It is a huge festival. Like, I didn't remember that Rascal Flatts was on it, but I'm sure there were some other big bands. I think Kelsey Ballerini was playing that day.
Yeah, I just remember Jim Riley's drum kit was set up already, and
the stage was
ginormous,
huge, but also packed with gear. Like, they didn't strike anybody's gear. So there was what we call an ego ramp, which is the ramp that goes out into the audience kind of thing. We call it an ego ramp. It's, you can figure it out why.
I'll take over the story for a moment.
Sure.
We get on stage, and there's two on mine and Jeff's side of the stage. We're on stage right, you're on stage left.
Yeah.
And you and I walk on stage, and I'm like, I'd never been nervous in my life to go on stage.
Right.
But this was a whole, again, this is like fish out of water.
Yeah.
So as it is, I'm like nervous about my equipment and my sound, and I'm not liking my sound yet. I'm uncomfortable.
Sure.
And we get on stage, and there's a little baby, what we call a combo amp. For the lay listener.
Single 12-inch speaker,
like
small.
Like what I would consider to be a practice amp in my bedroom. And I look at you and I'm like, where's my amp? And you're like, it's that one right there. And I'm like, no, my amp. And you're like, it's that right there. I'll be on stage left. Yeah. We're running out of time here. Yeah. We're on a tight crunch. So I'm just going, oh my God. So I hook up my gear, and again, I'm used to, you know, hitting a chord on the guitar and it's like, whoa, and I plug in and I hit a chord and it's like plink, you know, from my perspective, relatively.
For what you're used to.
For what I was used to. So anyway, you know, we get into the show and...
Well, it's to explain too, like I think we had the only people that had really done the gig prior to this gig were myself and I think Lockerman.
Yeah. So it was Rob Mitchell's first time playing,
Matt Heasley's first time playing.
Right, and mine.
And yours. And so I was made the unofficial or official band leader for the day.
Yep.
And along with driver, so things that I'm kind of new to. So I'm like, all right, I think I can handle the band leader slot for today. It's not really, these guys all know what they're doing, whatever. But the stage setup, it was basically Matt Heasley, the keyboard player, and I way on stage left. And then an enormous drum kit with a bunch of other gear that I could barely see past. And then you, Jeff Lockerman on bass and Rob Mitchell on drums, all kind of clustered together 25 feet away from us or more, maybe 50 feet away from us. And then Chuck was going to be out on this ramp. So there was very little line of sight with one another, which is important if you're playing with some, you know, guys that you've never really played with.
Yeah.
It's different if you all know the gig, but some of us were. And so...
Yeah, that did help my nerves.
Well, I remember too that we were crunched for time, and we drove and Chuck was not there yet and was flying in.
Right.
And I think we were kicking off the festival. I think we were the first act of the day. So Chuck gets there and TSA had broken his acoustic guitar, had ripped the wires out of his electronics. So his acoustic guitar wasn't working. So he borrowed an acoustic from the girl who was going to be on after us. I don't remember who she was, but right. I remember hearing this conversation between our front of house guy, Ronnie, and one of the techs, but I don't think anyone else heard it. I specifically don't think Chuck heard it, but somebody said she tunes to standard pitch or whatever or something. She was in a different tuning. Mm-hmm. And they're like, if you need to change it, you can, but make sure you give it back to us tuned back up to whatever it's supposed to be.
Sure.
We start the show and we get to this song. I think it was it Whole Damn Thing? Or it was Whole Damn Thing. And now we've all done this. We've all done this. I don't know if you've done it or not, but I've stuck the capo in the wrong spot and started the song in the wrong key. Well, Chuck does this quite a bit here and there, like we all do.
Quite a bit here and there.
Well, no, he does. And again, this is not anything disparaging towards anybody.
I know. It's just
especially
funny
if Chuck's listening. This is something that it happens all the time. So he had capoed, because it was the tuning thing. He had capoed one capo down from where we normally played the song. So we're a half step lower.
Yes.
He is starting the song on his acoustic. I realize it. And I don't think anyone else had realized that. I looked back at Heasley right behind me and I said, dude, I hope you can transpose on the fly. We're playing this a half step down. And this is in front of
thousands of people.
So Chuck is starting the song in a different key. This is like if you're a musician out there and you want to know what sometimes happens, sometimes you got to know your shit because so we're a half step down. So I am like jumping up and down, like trying to wave a flag.
So I'll take it over for a second here. So from our perspective, you know, we hear him playing and, you know, Michael has a way better ear than I do as a singer, all that.
I don't know about that.
He realizes that. No, you did because you realized it.
Yeah.
I was just like, in my mind, I'm like, okay, so it goes A and then Shaman, and then the soul. And out of the corner of my eye, I see Michael looking like my mom at the airport. He's jumping up and down, waving his arms on stage in front of thousands of people, the poor guy. And I look over and I just see him kind of mouthing, half step down, half step down, half step down, while waving his fingers, while waving his arms. And I think this is my first time playing a quote unquote country show in Nashville. There's thousands of people.
And you're on a festival show.
It's a festival show. And I think I literally blurted out loud, are you fucking kidding me right now? And again, it's one of those things where, of course, I've done this hundreds of times.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
We're not playing some complicated, I mean, it's an amazing song, but it's not a complicated jazz song or something.
Right.
You know, it's just playing everything one fret below. But the problem is that as a guitar player, if you guys
sometimes
are listening, you
count on open strings.
Sometimes you count on open strings, and this was one of these things. So I'm losing all my open chords. I'm going, okay, great. So not only do I have to play the solo a half step lower, which again, not the end of the world. It's a melodic solo.
Sure.
But I'm losing all my chords, so now I'm doing the lame bar chord version of this song now.
Right.
So anyway, you know, we get through it. No one makes any mistakes.
Well, I'll interject.
We didn't get through it without mistakes.
No, we did. We did, actually. Because everybody on that stage was a pro. And we all figured out. Like, Heasley went, I got it. Cool. Larkin was like, I got it. You went a little white at first. Like, I was
and
like,
for me, that's a feat.
I'll never forget your face because I was like, oh, fuck God. I felt for you too because I'm like, God, I this sucks. Like, you know, for me, it was just as easy as moving the capo down. Yeah. But you were doing some more complicated
and again,
stuff.
I don't want to make it seem like it was, you know, a huge deal.
Nobody would have noticed.
It's just more of, you know, the exact situation. Like today, I would laugh it off.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be a big deal. But remember, this was my first one.
Of course.
And there's 3,000 people. I mean, the last thing I wanted to do was butcher, you know, all of Chuck's amazing hit single songs.
Right.
On stage. In front of thousands of people. So,
well, it was funny because we got through that tune okay, and again, it was. I'll reiterate that we were all separated by such a great distance on this stage that there was in the moment there was no communicating to Chuck or to you guys without like making a huge gesture of it because Chuck was way out on this ramp like interacting with the fans at the end, so he's playing the song. And it's kind of like, well, I hope the band is going to be there when I start this thing, and which we were.
Yeah, of course.
But so the next tune was Stealing Cinderella, which is the other big hit. And so he capos in the same place for those two songs. So he was getting ready to start. I heard him getting ready to start the next song. And I remember you guys all looking at me like,
do something.
Are we playing this one in a half step lower too? Because, you know, when you lower the key too, everything starts sounding like, you know.
Yeah.
So I was like, no, 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 no. And so without talking to anybody, I started playing the acoustic part for that loud and proud in the right key. And Chuck figured it out and just stopped playing and you know, kind of went. So we did it in the right key. But I'll never forget Ronnie coming up to me afterwards and giving me a big hug and going, oh, man, that could have been. That could have been a lot worse. Thank you for, you know, thanks for helping out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, you know, like, again, generally speaking, doing something a half step lower or higher, not a big deal, but it also depends on the situation. If you're a guitar player, sometimes you lose chords and you have to really, really, you know, rethink on the spot.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, you know, and again, this is not super loud music where you can get away with stuff. You know, this is music where it could be down to a whisper.
There's a lot of subtlety and a lot of
There's a lot of, you know.
Yeah, right.
You know, everyone's down and whatever. If someone hits
a wrong note, it's going to be
It's going to be like, you know, it's going to be it's a flashing neon sign.
It's not jazz, or it's jazz if you do it twice.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's
there's not wrong if you do it twice.
Yeah. Once is a mistake, twice is jazz.
Right.
We were trying not to, you know, make it do the jazz version.
We made it through though, and I think that was good. I think everybody's got like that story.
Yeah.
Because my first gig here was like, oh Jesus, like the same kind of thing where it was like, I, you know, you just, especially coming from the worlds that we both come from, which are more the rock kind of situation when you start playing country, has your playing changed at all since that time? Like what, can you point to a couple things that like maybe you've gotten better at or you've done differently now that you're here?
Well, like I said, right in the beginning, I had to completely, reevaluate my sound. You know, I sold these amps and speaker cabinets that I'd been on the road with for years because they just weren't gonna work.
Right.
So I had to figure out, you know, how to be myself, but also be able to be at home in a quote unquote country, you know, gig if need be. That took a while. You know, that took, I would say, between your help, Chris's help, you know, everyone else's help. It took, I would say, a solid year before I was semi-comfortable.
Yeah.
And now I've only finally been like pretty good with it for about a year, believe it or not. You know, I started with sort of the quote unquote standard guitar pedals and amps that everyone, you know, that are kind of, you know, that are always going to work.
Right.
You know, Chris was the one who was just like, look, you know, just get, you know, get a really good Fender 212 tube amp. Can't go wrong with that.
Right.
That's always going to be a good bass. The other thing that I had never done was use what we call house gear, which you know about.
Sure.
You know, when you do a fly date and it's, you know, backlined where the festival just rents equipment and everyone uses the same amp.
Yeah.
I'd always used my own gear.
Right.
You know, so he said, you have to have your pedals and, you know, you have to be able to play in any situation. So it took me a good solid year to be semi-comfortable. Now I finally got it, you know, figured out, so, you know, with the amps and all that. That's the first glaring thing. The second thing is also what I mentioned before. I'd never owned a capo.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'd always been in an original band. We never used a capo.
Yeah, right.
So I had to get used to that a little bit as far as just changing a perspective on learning how to play in different keys and that kind of thing. Learning how to play some basic slide guitar, you know, doing, you know, hybrid picking, you know, using your fingers to, to get kind of a, you know, a more plucky, you know, what, the, you know, the, you know, the chicken picking vibe is the, you know, that's the layman term or guitar player term.
Sure.
So yeah, I had to, you know, and again, not that I've mastered that in any way,
right.
But, yeah, I mean, I'm a way, way, way different.
Yeah.
You know, I lost some stuff that I used to be able to do better, but I gained a lot more. You know, as I mentioned, the main thing I do right now is a pop band.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pop, some country, some Latin, some rock, some R&B. So I had to figure out
equipment. Be super versatile with everything. Yeah,
so I have to figure out a guitar and pedal board to play Bruno Mars and then play Sweet Child of Mine and then play a Marvin Gaye song and then play an Enrique Iglesias song.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and have it all be, if possible, the same guitar and all that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I basically had to reevaluate everything.
There's a lot more that goes into that than most people realize. That, like,
A lot more. And, you know, there's, you know, I also play with a, you know, with a country artist that kind of, you know, that likes rock, you know. So I get to kind of go back to that a little bit with him and use my Les Paul and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you just, the bottom line is you basically have to be able to do whatever is asked of you down here. Yep. And for the, you know, the core years of my life in my 20s and 30s, all I had to do was what my band needed me to do.
Right.
Which ultimately was what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't up to anybody else.
Right. Let's go back to Eve to Adam. Like when you were starting out, like what was going on in your house? Was it, are you an only child or?
I am.
Okay. So was there, are your parents musical or did they expose you to lots of music? How did that all kind of get started?
They did. My dad's side is all musicians and artists. My grandfather on my dad's side played sitar.
Oh, wow.
He actually was a gold medal winner in India.
Which really?
Is, you know, it's some sort of award, obviously, that they have for that. But, you know, again, you know.
He was an Olympic gold medalist sitarist.
Exactly. No one could run faster than him with his sitar and jump over hurdles, that's which good. Is hard when you're holding a sitar.
Those are big.
Yeah, those are big. But, you know, again, it's the 1920s and 30s in India. So, that, you know, being a musician, that's not a real job. Get a real job. Get married.
Oh, yeah.
So,
okay.
You know, he did. I mean, I have, I can actually show you. I have him here. I have framed pictures of him conducting the orchestra on All India Radio.
Oh, wow.
When I was growing up in New Jersey, when I was a little kid, there was a picture in my parents' house, which in my 8-year-old mind, I just perceived as two old Indian guys. And then one day, that's the air bubble that came up in my head when I was a little kid. And then one day in my teens, I asked my dad finally, I was like, who is that? And he was like, that's your grandfather with Ravi Shankar.
Oh, shit. Really?
And I was like,
okay,
wait, what? And he was like, yeah, they were friends. Your granddad was one of his mentors. He came over for lunch one day and I took the picture. So there's literally, I have that here too. I'll show it to you.
That's crazy.
I have a picture that so this is like the mid 50s. My dad's about 15.
Okay.
And he took a picture of my granddad and Ravi Shankar. And I didn't recognize Ravi Shankar because he was in his 30s. He
young,
had
young
black
guy,
and
young
yellow,
guy. Yeah, right.
You know? So, you know, my grandfather was musical, but didn't do it for a living.
Mm-hmm.
So my oldest uncle that lives in New Jersey plays tablas. He actually played I did an instrumental EP 20 years ago in my studio. Okay. So him and my mom sang and my uncle played tablas.
Oh, so lots of music around.
Yeah. My youngest uncle played sitar. Then it basically went to me doing this, obviously. And, my cousin, mm-hmm. who's my dad's older brother's son, they remained in India. They didn't immigrate over.
Okay.
But my cousin is basically he's a director.
Uh-huh.
He's a television director.
Okay.
That had a huge comedy show a few years ago. Now he does a new one and he is the director, like their version. They have a version of the Emmys in mm-hmm. India, you know, an award show.
Sure.
And he's the director that wins every year.
Oh, wow.
For best comedy series.
Okay.
So me and my cousin continue that. So my dad's side is my mom's side. My uncle, my mom's brother he's a visual artist.
Okay.
And my mom sings, you know,
yeah.
You know, amateur obviously, but, you know, sure. very well. So yeah, we were, you know, I was exposed to a lot of Indian music or whatever, but you know, needless to say, right. growing up here,
when did your family come over? Would your grandparents move here and then your parents were born in India?
My parents were born in India right after they got married in 1968. My dad was living, believe it or not, people gasp when I tell them this because of what it's turned into. But my dad and my uncle actually lived in Kabul, Afghanistan.
Oh, wow.
In the late 60s.
Okay.
Because it wasn't what we know it as now.
Yeah, right.
They needed accountants.
Mm.
And my dad was an accountant.
Okay.
Is an accountant.
Yeah.
So a lot of young Indian accountants would move to Kabul to work there because the job opportunities
sure.
were great. So they got married for the first 6 months they lived there. And then they went straight from there to Flushing, Queens.
Really? Like what? For what reason? Just wanted to get out and make a better life kind
yeah.
of? Or?
The main reason anyone, you know,
yeah.
moves here, you know, is
right.
the opportunity is a better life, all that.
What
so.
Was going, was there turmoil? I know nothing about it. So was there, what was
no.
going on there? Just, they just kind of wanted to.
Yeah, no, they just, you know, they just knew that there was way more opportunity in this country.
Sure.
You know, the typical
yeah.
immigrant story, you know,
yeah,
the American
right.
dream, all that stuff.
Right.
At the time the world wasn't, I mean, in the late 60s, you know, I mean, let's put it this way, on the way from Kabul to here, uh-huh. my parents stopped and did some sightseeing in Beirut. Which again, see people right. laugh when yeah, you tell
right.
them that.
Yeah, right.
But my mom still has these really, really nice pictures from that trip.
Right.
Where it's yeah. just like this beautiful city with like flower gardens and all that. It's really a shame, you know, that all these yeah, places, right. obviously that's a whole other story, but you know, all these places that they used to live and visit yeah. have turned into, you know, what, I mean, war you zones. Literally, you know, you LOL'd when well, I said that because I you mean, were like, when you think yeah, of Beirut, it's, I mean, you see, you think of bombs going off.
Yeah, right.
Man. So, one of my dad's close friends in Kabul mm-hmm. Had gotten married, and his wife's a doctor. So they lived in Queens already. They okay. lived in the Bronx, actually. So they were the only people that my parents knew. They uh-huh. literally picked them up at the airport. They stayed with them for a little bit. And then my parents moved into a building in Flushing in Queens. And they started meeting all these other young Indian couples that live there.
Yeah.
And crazy as it is, it's the same friends they have today. And the little kids that my mom met in the laundry room,
yeah,
you know, like she met, she met a young mother in the laundry room. There was two little kids. Those kids are now in their 50s, and we still know them, and we've been to all their weddings, and they have kids now.
Oh, wow.
They still have the same friends
uh-huh.
that they made That's in incredible. Flushing at that time. Yeah, right. So they lived there for a few years, and then when my mom actually worked at Prudential in the city.
Okay.
So had she not quit when she got pregnant, she probably would have been retired right now as some, you know, if she'd stayed with Prudential, she probably would have retired at some pretty high post.
Sure.
So when she got pregnant, my dad bought his first house in New Jersey.
Okay.
And then that was the first, you know, the first house, and then just stayed yeah. in that area.
Yeah. Was guitar always kind of like what was your first, what got you, how'd you get the guitar bug?
My first best friend that I made in, I think, second grade,
yeah.
Brian Harvey, brought over a cassette tape to my parents' house. Uh-huh. And it was a very disturbing album image of a really demented looking dude with, he was kind of holding his arm up and laying on this wooden floor, and there was like some bones or a dead bat or something like that. I was like, this looks interesting. And it turned out that it was Blizzard of Oz, first Ozzy right. Osbourne solo record.
There you go.
And if you remember this time, we're dating ourselves. But who cares?
I do remember it a little too well.
When you open a cassette tape, especially if it was like a, you know, CBS record or something, the inside of the cassette tape was blank.
Right.
There was no album credits.
No anything. Yeah.
There was no anything. It just had the names of the songs on the cassette in the running order. So. If you remember, I know you're probably not a huge, I don't think you're a huge Ozzy fan, but the first song is the song I Don't Know,
mm-hmm.
and it opens, and again, we're talking about Randy Rhoads,
yeah,
who
right.
I didn't know at the time who it was. I'll get to that in a second.
Sure.
So, you know, I hear this gargantuan, the I Don't Know riff, you right. know, that we all know,
yeah.
if you're an Ozzy fan,
yeah.
and like, you know, the gong goes off, and it comes in, and I'm just, you know, whatever, and then the next song comes in, and it's, you know, Crazy Train, you hear boom, boom,
yeah, boom, yeah,
boom,
yeah.
boom, 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 I, you know, and it's yeah. like, he does this pick scrape before yeah. he starts, the riff. It's like, you know, and I'm just sitting there, like, almost scared, you know, and I didn't even know it was a guitar.
Right.
I just thought it was just this sound that was amazing.
Yeah,
you know
yeah,
what I
yeah.
mean? And then, I, you know, me in my, so if this is like, you know, I'm like seven.
Sure.
So in my 7-year old mind, I'm thinking, okay, well, I guess this is Ozzy Osbourne that's doing everything.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, wow, Ozzy Osbourne's a great guitar yeah. player. You know, so.
He is not.
He is not. As we now know, as I found out a few years later. So that was the first thing, you know, and again, this is, you know, MTV was out, but we didn't have cable at the yeah. time. So there was no info. So again, I just thought like, you know, this is cool, whatever. And then, you know, Journey was huge at that point. So we yep. all loved like Separate Ways and yeah, all those songs right. and everything. So at that point I would just listen to the radio with my cousins. Those yeah. are the days where we used to get our boom boxes out and make mixtapes from the radio. You would wait, you know, for the intro, and then you would miss the intro.
You'd miss the intro
and then hit it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
your recording would be the first two words. You know, cut off and all that stuff. So we would sit around and do that like everybody else did.
Were you exposed to MTV at all when it was cool?
I was.
First
so
starting?
One of my cousins had cable, so we okay. went over there. And then I always looked for an Ozzy Osbourne video. And then finally I saw one, and it was Bark at the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
But the guitar sounded different. I didn't really know why or whatever. But then, you know, that's also when Jump was out.
Jake Healy was playing at that point, right?
So that's when I fell in love with Van Halen. Because then there was a visual to the thing. So when the video for Jump came out, you know, it's like there's the, you know, there's this guy, and he's, you know, he's wearing this, like a, what was it? It was like a yellow zebra jacket and he's got this crazy red and white guitar and he just can't stop smiling, you know, and he's playing his guitar and then he does a guitar solo and he's doing something up on the neck. He's hitting the neck with his right finger. What's going on here? And then all of a sudden he's doing a keyboard solo. You know, I was like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Obviously it's Eddie Van Halen.
Right.
So then that's when the guitar bug really bit me, when I kind of realized like, okay, this is an electric guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's when the connection got made. And then I think the next year, I think a week before my 9th birthday, I got my first guitar and started taking lessons.
Oh yeah. Electric or acoustic?
Electric.
Oh,
okay. I did manage to get my parents.
Oh, so you started on electric.
I did.
Wow.
I did. Okay. Oh yeah. I mean, come on, look how cool I am. I was this badass at 9, bro.
I can see.
Who do you think you're talking to? So I convinced my parents to buy, it was a Mach 1 black, of course.
Okay, sure.
Black guitar and one of those little Gorilla baby, you know, it was like a five inch speaker, which, you know, everyone around her age remembers. But again, you know, I started taking lessons and it was the Hal Leonard book.
Yeah.
And, you know, typical story, which to this day I relate to my students, is like, you know, it's like I'm sitting there and, you know, we're learning how to play, like we're learning how to read music and mm-hmm. play notes and I'm learning these chords and the teacher, we're kind of playing all these songs that are old and I don't know them.
Right.
And then, you know, eventually, you know, it's like, when are we going to learn how to play the beginning of Hot for Teacher? And the guy's like, we're not.
Yeah.
You're 9.
We're not. You're 9.
So, you know, eventually, you know, and I was really into baseball at the time. So, again, boredom set in and I kind of stopped playing.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
So flash forward. Are we keeping going with this train?
Yeah.
Of thought?
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So flash forward to I've kind of not been playing guitar. I'm really into baseball. I was doing Little League. So at that time, that's when the Yankees started getting
really good. Were you a good baseball player?
I was. I was a Little League baseball player. Yeah.
Okay.
So, funny side note. Guess what team I was on?
No idea.
7-Eleven. And to this day, I wonder whether that was a calculated racist move where somebody, the guy who was putting the teams together, was kind of like, we're going to put the Indian at 7-Eleven. Or whether it was just coincidence. I do know that after we won a game, we would go get a free Slurpee, so I don't care. But to this day, I wonder.
So your team was actually not just named 7-Eleven. 7-Eleven was the sponsor for the...
So I actually used to play baseball. So you actually... Think of how funny this is. You actually had an 8-year-old Indian kid with a uniform, and on the shirt, on the jersey, it said 7-Eleven. Oh, and I had pictures of me in it. Needless to say, I can't look at them because I would have a heart attack laughing so hard, like you're about to do. For this, since you can't see us, Michael's head looks like a cherry right now because he's turning red.
Well, I have to say, man, you make fun of your ethnicity like incessantly. It's hilarious.
Well, it's the goofiest ethnicity. It's the easiest to make fun
of. I don't know about that. I mean, you know, but it's hilarious to me. Yeah. But have you had some bad experiences, right? Of people like.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, when we were little kids in the 80s, And here's another thing. Mm-hmm. Sorry, we're getting enough in too many tangents. We'll get back
Dude,
to the thing.
It all works.
So the Indiana Jones just came on Netflix.
Okay.
So needless to say,
oh, sure.
six okay. hours gone. All three. There's just no other way to do it.
Okay.
By the way, I don't count the crystal skull one. Doesn't count.
You're correct.
So
you win.
The movie that I loved and hated when I was a kid was Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Because it was really cool that it took place in India.
Right.
But it was really not cool because Steven Spielberg took all these liberties in his movie to make India seem like a very, very sinister and strange place.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you remember in this movie, they're at this palace.
Yeah.
Where there's this evil sect that's come up and they've kidnapped the children in this small village and stolen the sacred rock and all that stuff.
Sure.
You know, they're at the dinner with the Maharaja, with the king,
right?
Who's a child, and they're bringing the food. And the food is like, it's bugs
and monkey brains.
They bring a snake that they cut open. There's little snakes. And Kate Capshaw, who plays Spielberg's wife, who plays the female lead.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
You know, she's about to puke. And the little kid, Short Round, you know, is about to puke. And then, you know, the soup comes and she's like, oh, thank God, soup. And she puts her spoon in and eyeballs come out. And then, you know, it's like, you know, what's this? And the guy's like, dessert. Chilled monkey brain. And they bring the head of a monkey and the guy scoops up the, you know, whatever.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, I was 9 years old when that came out. So all the kids in my school thought that that's what Indian people eat. Because when you're a little kid, you don't have the perspective to know, like, this is a movie.
It's a movie, yeah.
Yeah, so the kids would be like, Bali, so what are you having for dessert? Chilled monkey brains? You know?
Jeez, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because yeah. they really thought that that's what, you know, whatever. So, right. you know, as I like to say, if I love Steven Spielberg, he's a genius. But if he's ever in front of me, he's losing some teeth. Because I'm going to punch that guy straight in the grill. Because he completely ruined my fourth grade year because of that. And yeah. to this day, I love the movie.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, when, you
well,
know,
it's going to be tough when you're a kid to, yeah, exactly, you know, to you be. Know,
my dad, you know, I'm sure got it way worse than I did because, sure. you know, here's a guy who, you know, he moved to the country, went to school again, as educated as yeah. he was. And then he did his CPA exam when I was about four.
Sure.
Started doing that. So he was, you know, I mean, he was kind of kicking everyone's ass at work, you know, in the city. He worked at this I huge bet. Insurance yeah. company on Park yeah. Avenue, and he was just steadily climbing. So mm-hmm. I'm sure he, you know, he got it. He never talked about it, but, you know, I'm sure he got it real bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, kids definitely were, you know, especially in grammar school.
Could be pretty cruel, probably.
Could be pretty cruel about that. Because uh-huh. again, it's like no one really knew what it was really, you know, what different cultures were about, and then someone puts out this huge movie,
right?
And people are like, "All right, well, I guess that's what yeah. happens in India."
Well, it's one of the things I love about you most is that you take the piss out of it a lot. Like, yeah, you know, like, I forget where we were, or what was going on. You tell me a story about somebody yelled at you, like, "Go back to where you came from," or something like that, and you're like, "I'm from Jersey."
Yeah, okay, I don't know if there was a specific one, but the first year I was here at summer NAM,
makes me laugh.
Me and our friend Elton Charles.
I mean, I'm sorry, but it's
well, yeah. me and our friend Elton Charles uh-huh. were walking on De Munbrien in front of the convention yeah, center yeah. with you know, with a couple of our Caucasian friends, and somebody else yelled something about me and Elton, which I won't repeat. So, but we look basically you know, for someone who doesn't know any better, we're right. you know, we're Arabs, we're Talheads. So someone yelled something that I can't repeat, and then, you know, Elton flipped them off, and I looked around when the guy yelled the racial slur.
Yeah.
I was like, where are they? And Elton's like, he's talking about us, dude. And I was like, oh, no, we're from Jersey. I think that may be what you were talking about.
Yeah, that's the story. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, but it's, you know, honestly, I can say that, touch wood, I haven't, you know, did I just say touch wood?
You said touch wood. It's okay. Knock on wood. I was going to let it slide.
And you know why? You know why I said that? Because that's what Indian people say, and me and my cousins make fun of it. Touch wood. Yeah.
Touch wood.
Yeah. They say. Okay. You know,
is that the equivalent of knock on wood?
No, it's just wrong. It's just the wrong saying.
Yeah. Okay.
Me and my cousins make fun of it so much that I actually said it myself.
Okay.
Knock on wood. I haven't had any like blatant. Like I've never felt like a danger. But yeah, I mean, in the 80s, you know, thanks to Steven Spielberg, like I said, yeah, watch your back, bro.
Damn you, Spielberg.
Yeah, watch your back, bro. I'm coming after you. Thanks to Temple of Doom and, you know, this other stuff, there's just so much, you know, people just don't really know.
Well, there's stereotypes.
They do exist for a reason, but, you know, and another person, as much as I love him, mm-hmm. you know, Hank Azaria, the guy who does Apu on The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. You know, as funny as that accent is, no one in my family sounds like that.
Right.
You know, I mean, obviously me and my cousins don't have accents because we grew up here, but, you know, even our parents don't have that, you know, I mean, I flat out call it the Apu, you know, my dad and my mom are college educated. All my aunts and uncles
sure,
are.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do they have an accent? Of course they do.
Of course.
But it's more of like a British influence. You know, they say schedule, you know, they say bloody.
Right,
you know,
of course.
This bloody guy, you know, because India used to be under British rule.
Yeah, under British rule.
So
a
lot of that vernacular, you know, it's very British sounding. But, you know, anyway, Spielberg, watch your back. So, anyway, sorry, I don't remember how we got to this train of thought, but no, it was started with the, I was bored of guitar because I was playing for 7-Eleven.
Well, that was it. Yeah, yeah. Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to derail it.
Yeah,
but
so so everyone feel free to laugh if you're listening. There was actually an Indian kid playing baseball and on his jersey, it said 7-Eleven. And I have the pictures to prove it. So when I was 12, I was still into, you know, hard rock, heavy metal, whatever. And an Ozzy Osbourne album called Tribute came out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a live album.
Yeah.
So I bought this album and I recognized those old songs from when I was 7, when my friend Brian brought that tape over. Mm-hmm. And at this point, you know, they were putting liner notes and, not CDs yet, but in records and tapes or whatever. And I started buying like Circus Magazine and Rip and Kerrang, and me and my cousins would buy all the rock magazines. And then that is when all of a sudden the light bulb went on that the guy who was playing guitar on those songs had died in a plane crash that year.
Yeah, right.
And that's why I never heard those songs again, really. And I didn't hear that exact sound again.
Yeah.
So then, because, you know, Ozzy writes this letter, you know, to Randy Rhoads in the tribute album, and you're reading it. And that's when all of a sudden it was like, oh, that's what happened.
Right.
This is a live recording from 1982 before he passed away.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've ever heard that record.
I've heard portions of it. Yeah.
It's iconic.
Sure.
I mean, it's just like, because again, he didn't have the opportunity to go back and fix anything up.
No, right.
This is what he played that night.
Yeah.
And it's like stupefying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's when I got really into guitar again, and I started learning about Randy, and that, you know, he was a guitar teacher also, and how he, you know, I became like a Randy Rhoads fanatic, and I was still into Eddie and all that.
Yeah.
And then I started playing again, and that's when there was a lot of tools for us, guitar for the practicing musician and guitar player and all that.
Yep.
And then tablature was out by that time. You know, so you could actually learn how to play a Van Halen song or an Ozzy song or, you know, whoever U2.
Yeah, right.
You know, U2 was already huge by then. So, you know, Guitar Magazine would come out and it would have like Crazy Train Live.
Yeah.
And it would have Where the Streets Have No Name and some other song. Sure, or whatever.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so
yeah.
You're learning, you know, and then it was like, you know, you'd look at The Streets Have No Name and it was like, stereo delay set to something milliseconds. And then you go, what's that?
Right.
You know, and then you learn like, oh, so that's how the Edge gets that sound.
It was kind of funny back then, like without the internet, with all that stuff, like how knowledge would kind of matriculate its way around and you'd have to really have to be a detective almost to figure out.
You would have to either have another friend or an older person to tell you how it happens, or you'd have to read a magazine or something like that. I have an older cousin who's 6 years older than me that I grew up with in New Jersey. He lives in Raleigh now with his family. And he was like my big brother growing up, basically.
Yeah.
The uncle that plays tabla I was telling you about, his son.
Oh, okay. All right.
So he's actually the one who got me into hard rock, because we would go to my uncle's house and I would go to my cousin's room and he would have posters of Motley Crue or Ozzy or Van Halen or whatever.
Right on.
And then that's where I started hearing all the music.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, he played drums too at the time. So I think he was the first one who told me what an electric guitar was as opposed to an acoustic. And he had, you know, he was 6 years older. So if I'm 12, he's already 17. He's in high school. So he's got friends that are playing music or whatever. I think he might've been the first one to say, well, you know, the way that you get that sound, you know, which we now know as distortion or overdrive, you know, he said they make these thing called pedals.
Yeah.
You know, you play your guitar and you step on it and it gives you that sound.
Right.
And then there's a one where you hit it and it plays the note again, which we now know as a delay pedal.
Right.
You know, so like you were saying, when, you know, around that time, you really, really either had to have an older sibling or friend or take lessons or a teacher who would tell you. Now, I tell my students all the time now, you know, they're like, well, how does he get that sound? Like, well, it's called reverb.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But again, when you're 8, how do you know
you
that?
You don't know anything.
You don't know anything.
Yeah.
You don't know that. So I slowly started figuring out all that stuff. And then I started playing again on my own.
Yeah.
I became a Van Halen fanatic.
Sure.
I bought a Kramer guitar because that's what Eddie was endorsing at the time. The one pickup Kramer. It was black, of course.
Oh, yeah,
that's
of course.
My first Floyd Rose tremolo, all that. And then I start, you know, I was doing that just by myself. And then when I was 15, I started really liking a lot of the kind of thrash and speed metal bands, like Metallica and all that, Megadeth, because they had, whether you like the music or not, they had a lot of great guitar players in there, very creative, cutting edge dudes, you know, that were just amazing. So I couldn't understand how to do all that stuff. So then I started taking lessons, and then I started taking lessons from what turned out to be like my main teacher, who taught me my technique and theory and all that.
Okay.
And then my senior year of high school, when I decided that this is what I was going to do, he'd opened a school, and basically he was like, you know, and again, since this is before YouTube and people thinking that they could learn how to play guitar from YouTube, which obviously doesn't end well nine times out of 10.
Yeah.
Because as I always say, you can't ask a video a question.
That's true.
And no, leaving a comment in the comment section is not asking a question. you know, he said, you know, people were, he had an influx of students. So he was like, well, you know, do you want to teach the beginners?
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, so I'll get the students and we'll split the money for the lesson half and half.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, are you serious? I was like, you can actually get paid doing this? And he was like, well, how do you think I make a living? And that's when kind of all of a sudden, again, the light bulb went on, like,
yeah.
Oh, okay. So you can, you know, besides just trying to be a rock star, you know, which is what we all want it to be, there's something that you can actually practically do.
Right.
So that's where that whole bug came in, which continues to this day, which is like, I really like doing this.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
There's no, you know, kind of going back to the thing of, you know, us having to figure out what a distortion pedal was or what delay was or what reverb was or how does Eddie Van Halen make that sound? How does the Edge get that? You know, there's, U2 has this thing that he always does. How does he do that? Because when I try to play the song,
it's different.
I'm playing the right notes, but it's not that sound. What is that sound?
Right.
And then we figure out that it's a delay pedal, you know?
Yeah.
So to this day, there's nothing as cool as telling a 10-year-old kid who Jimmy Page is.
Yeah.
Or who the Edge is, or who Eddie Van Halen is, or who, you know, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, because, and it's never gonna get old because, you know, you're, the thing is that no matter, you can say all day, like, yeah, of course, they have the internet now and there's a, you know, there's a wealth of information. But the bottom line is still, you know, it's gonna be really hard for, you know, it to get in a 9-year-old's head who Jimmy Page is, who Jimi Hendrix is, who the Edge is, who Eddie Van Halen is, who Slash is, who, you know, name your guy.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Right.
But anyway, so you know, that I started doing that, and then in high school, the whole thing was that I was gonna try to go to Berkeley.
Okay.
After high school, and then the summer I was 16, another interesting story, believe it or not, I lived in Hollywood the summer before my senior year because I was going to maybe go to Musicians Institute in Hollywood.
Oh, no kidding.
So there was a summer program. So, you know, my dad being just like a fearless, badass, like if I can do it, anyone can do it kind of guy, you know, he actually encouraged it. You know, my mom obviously was freaking, you know,
right.
She was not for it.
Well, that makes sense. Like, if you're going to do it, you may as well go and do it like for real. Yeah.
So they signed me up for this summer program the summer before my senior year of high school.
Right.
So, you know, I found two roommates.
Mm-hmm.
My parents flew out to LA with me. We got an apartment with two roommates. And
how old were you around this
16.
Time? 16.
Yeah.
So, wow. That's
My parents just dropped me off in Hollywood. And it was like two blocks away. It was right off Hollywood Boulevard in Hollywood. The school is on a side street called McCadden Place.
Mm-hmm.
And I was two blocks over on a side street called North Sycamore.
Okay.
There was a bunch of other students staying in the same complex who obviously were older than me, which we'll get to. So they hooked me up with an apartment.
Wow.
And left me some money. And my dad was just like, all right, our flight leaves in 2 hours. See ya. You know?
Wow.
And, you know, my mom just, you know, terror.
Yeah.
Obviously, as you can understand.
You know, and you're the only child. You're her baby, too.
This is 1991 in Hollywood. So this is still the end of the hairband era. So, you know, our parents have, you know, seen us watching MTV and seeing all these, like, crazy people that we idolize, like Motley Crue and Van Halen.
Right,
you know, we're watching Motley Crue Girls, 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 and they're at a strip club.
Yeah.
You know, my parents are like, you know, my mom is like, okay, so these are the kind of people that he's going to be around.
Right.
Great.
Yeah. Right.
So like I said, my dad, fearless, he was just like, you'll be fine.
Yeah. Right.
Just call us if you need anything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So, you know, of course they visited like probably every 3 weeks for the summer. So they came out about three times.
Uh-huh.
It was June, July and August because school began in September. Right?
Okay.
So they came out like about once a month,
mm-hmm.
just to check up. And, you know, my mom ended up, you know, really loving, you know, coming out there.
Yeah.
So anyway, I did that for the summer. And then I realized that basically the biggest douchebags on the planet were flocking to LA. Mm-hmm. Even at 16, I got a feel for that.
Right.
And I was like, nah, I don't want to do that. But, you know, I did, obviously, I got quite an education that summer.
Yeah.
You know, I learned, I was around a lot of great guitar players. I was around a lot of bad guitar players. I was around a lot of people who were doing it for the wrong reasons. Sure. I was around a lot of drug addicts.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was the first time I walked in to one of my friend's apartments, and one of his friends was sitting on the couch like we are right now. He had his arm tied off. Oof. And he was shooting up.
Yeah.
I didn't know what that was at the time.
Right.
I didn't know that you injected heroin.
Yeah.
At the time. So I found out what that was. there was a lot of drugs,
mm-hmm.
Which I didn't partake in.
Right.
I did drink a little bit for sure, obviously. Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was, you know, I mean, in high school, everyone drank. That wasn't, I don't think that's any shock, obviously.
We're all judging you right now.
Yeah, exactly. And the crowd gasps.
Oh my God.
but yeah, it was a crash course in a lot of stuff. It
yeah,
was
being right.
around a lot of crazy musicians from around the world. Everyone was 21 or over, and I was 16.
Okay.
I had practiced a good amount, so I actually was holding my own decently with the playing, right. believe it or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Because those were the days where, you know, I was into metal guitar, so you would just practice 6 hours a day.
Right.
All your, you know, sweep picking and alternate picking and all the, you know, all the dirty guitar stuff.
All that stuff that comes that in stuff. So, it's so in handy right now.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, it isn't, you know, not directly, but sure.
Technique-wise, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was like, LA is not for me, because mm-hmm. this is just every douchebag on the planet is
yeah, right.
flocking here to try to be a big star.
Right.
You know, so I went back home, did my senior year, and then that's when my teacher asked me to teach. So then when I graduated, you know, that's basically what I did. You
okay.
know, and that's yeah. when, you know, of course, I set out on my path to be a rock star. but yeah.
So Eve to Adam. So how long of a, you guys had a long run. It was,
we did. Well, so in the years before that, so I graduated, I was teaching for my teacher. My dad was nice enough to build me, we had an unfinished basement uh-huh. in my dad's house. He was nice enough to build me a little project studio.
Okay.
So this local producer that was really good, he designed it.
Uh-huh.
And then the contractor that had built our house built the studio.
Oh, wow.
So okay. it was like a nice little, you know, like a real studio. It had a
yeah.
control room and
a
studio, and it had the glass in between, and, you know, started out with like a 24 channel Mackie board. And those were the days of ADATs, if you
sure.
remember.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know? So I had a couple of those. So yeah, I had a little 16 track studio and started messing around. So then I started messing around with recording and how to record myself. And then I realized very quickly that, you know, when a microphone is in front of your amp, it's like basically taking a picture of yourself. You know, if you're just standing in front of someone and you have a zit, they probably can't see it. If you take a picture of yourself with that said zit, it's going to say zit. So that's what recording is. You know, you put a microphone in front of your amplifier, all of a sudden a mistake you never knew you were making
is wide open. Right.
So that's when I learned kind of how to record and, you know, how difficult
yeah.
that is. And that's an art form in and of itself,
it is.
And all that.
Yeah, definitely.
So I did, I was doing instrumental stuff and writing guitar riffs uh-huh. and stuff like that. Cause you know, I mean, my idols were, you know, Eddie Van Halen and Jimmy Page.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
you know, when you would read interviews, they would say, yeah, I write instrumental songs basically. And then a singer turns it into vocal songs.
Sure.
I was like, great. Sounds good. I'll do that.
Yeah, right.
So I just started writing music, and I did an instrumental EP at the end of 1998,
mm-hmm.
Where, like I mentioned, there's a kind of Indian flavored song where I did this crazy tuning on the acoustic, and
yeah.
my uncle played tabla and my mom sang and all that. And then that was around the time that I started trying to do a band. So by then, you could, because again, when we were growing up, the traditional route was either friends of friends or you would put an ad out in some paper.
Right.
In 1998, you could put an ad on for those who don't know, the Village Voice is a very famous newspaper in New York City, which
yeah.
you know. So at that time, the Village Voice, there was villagevoice.com.
Okay.
And there was a classified section.
Yeah.
So I put an ad out saying that I was putting a band together and, you know, yeah. had some music and my influences, whatever, you know, probably, you know, Stone Temple Pilots, Soundgarden, Van Halen.
Yeah, sure.
You know, some other stuff. And, these were still in the days of answering machines. So,
yeah.
You know, I got home one day, checked my messages. Mm-hmm. The 50th call I got, this guy left a message, and he was like, hey, you know, me and my brother just moved up from Florida.
Right.
We're looking for a guitar player, and we already have an existing band. And we have a development deal and a record deal with a songwriter named Desmond Child. Okay. I don't know if you know who he is. And I was like, you know, by this time I was already really into music and magazines were out and you could whatever. And I already knew that he was the guy that either wrote or co-wrote all the really big Bon Jovi songs and Aerosmith and Kiss.
Huge.
And, you know, huge. Not to mention Garth Brooks, Shania Twain's. And needless to say, I called him back. And that ended up being the singer and the drummer from Eve to Adam. So they had the name already. And they had both gone to the University of Miami for a little while. Okay. And Desmond had started a production company with his manager, Winston Simone, who was in New York, in the city. So they combined Desmond and Winston, and they came up with Destin Entertainment.
Sure.
So at the time, Desmond was still living in Miami on South Beach. So my former singer interned at Destin when he was going to college.
Okay.
He ended up being, you know, like Desmond's running partner and this and that. And, you know, finally one, you know, Desmond finally asked him, like, so you're a singer and a songwriter. What do you got, kid? So he ended up signing them to a development deal. There actually was another version of that band in Miami, but obviously, as anyone knows, especially from Miami, there is no rock scene there, really. So they got nowhere quickly. But they had some great songs that they had written with Desmond, obviously.
Wow.
Did
you ever work with him?
I did.
Wow. Okay.
So basically, Desmond's advice was, this ain't happening. Fire these two guys, and you guys need to live a little, because they grew up sort of like I did. Their dad is a gastroenterologist in Sarasota, which is a very, very nice area of Florida. So they grew up, you know, very, you know, just nicely.
Well off.
Well. Sure. So he was like, you guys, you know, you guys need to get your asses kicked a little bit. You need to eat a little bit of shit, because if you're going to be an artist, you have to have something to write about.
You have to,
You know, you're, okay, great. You're a songwriter. Well, what are you writing songs about?
That's it.
You haven't done anything yet.
Yeah,
and he was right.
Yeah,
I was in the same boat.
Yeah, yeah.
So he suggested they fire the other two and move to New York and get into their own place and live a little.
Right.
Live in New York.
Yeah, right.
You know, eat some shit in New York as an artist.
Yeah.
So they did that. And so they moved up and they saw my ad and they called me and... you know, like I said, I had, you know, a huge stockpile of guitar riffs and chord progressions and all these ideas for songs that I wanted to present to a singer. You know, and he was, you know, he's a great singer. He's a great lyricist, a very good lyricist and great at melodies. I was like, great, you know, so it just, it turned into one of those things where like, okay, cool. And, you know, the first time we got together, I think we wrote two or three songs that ended up on our first album we did together. So at this time we were still working with Desmond. So Desmond, they had a very, very shitty rehearsal room in what was called the Music Building. I'm sorry, the Music Building was the one in Queens that the Metallica were at. This was, I forget what the name it was, but it was by Port Authority, New York, which, as you know, is not a nice area.
Nope, yeah.
It was the same building that Madonna had her room in, like in the late 70s and early 80s. We shared it with two other bands, so there was a schedule when you could rehearse.
Right,
like,
yeah, I've done
every
that
band
before.
Set up their drum kit in a corner. You know, in the summer, the AC never works. It was boiling. In the winter, the heat never works. It was free. It was, you know, it was one of those.
Yeah,
it was the stereotypical, you know, starting out in your 20s, shitty rehearsal room.
Exactly.
So Desmond flew up from Miami to see us play, listen to the songs we were writing, but he didn't really connect with me. You know, he thought I was a little too conservative and dorky. In his defense, he was right. Because again, looking back 20 years later, I'd never done anything.
Right.
So, of course, I wasn't going to be a developed artist.
Yeah, right.
But he did like the songs we were working on. He didn't love them, but they had some good songs. So, you know, we started working on stuff with him a little bit. I went down to, he invited us down to Miami to do some writing. This is when Livin' La Vida Loca by Ricky Martin was the biggest song on the planet, basically. So this was like 1999 now we're talking about. So again, we're all, you know, I mean, we're like 20, 21, and 23. I was the oldest.
Yeah.
And we were still babies. We hadn't done anything.
Yeah, right.
You know? So in a nutshell, you know, the more that we started writing, we meaning me and the singer started writing songs by ourselves, because the stuff with Desmond was awesome, but it was a little more on the pop side, as you can imagine from him, because that's his forte and that's what he's a genius at.
Right.
But you know, we were into, you know, we were into Tool and Soundgarden and grew up on Guns N' Roses and Metallica and all that. So we wanted to do something a little bit, you know, a little bit more hard edged.
Right.
So I think Desmond, when he found out that it was going to be kind of not what he thought it was going to be originally, he started getting a little less interested. And then next thing you know, he was like, I think we should part ways. So, you know, they, you know, we parted ways with him. And so we started from scratch. We started demoing in my studio. We actually ended up getting a record deal with an indie label and hired, you know, a producer and all this stuff to do it. And then the first check bounced. So that started, you know, on the path to having a few record deals and putting out records, you know, for the next 15 yeah. years. The main mistake I made throughout those years was we, like, the commendable thing, if you want to put it that way, was that we had tunnel vision. We believed in ourselves. We thought that we were a band that deserved to be able to, you know, just make a living.
At least. Sure, yeah.
You know, after a few years, obviously the whole thing of being a rock star and playing at arenas and stadiums and all that, that eventually reality sets in. And especially when we were coming, you know, in the early, late 90s, early 2000s, that's when Napster came and people all of a sudden stopped buying records.
Right.
So that also started happening. Then it was like all of a sudden there was a generation of people that thought that music should be this thing for free on the internet. And then it did turn into that.
They still think that, yeah.
They still think that. So then that whole thing happens. It was just a very weird time to try to get into making a living playing music. So the mistake I made was that we had tunnel vision, and I never, you know, we never thought like, hey, you know, let's try to get one of our songs licensed, let's try to get it in a movie, let's try to get it on TV, let's do it. So that's the one thing we didn't do. And it was just one of those things where, like, every time we thought we'd have to quit, someone would come out of the woodwork and say, no, no, don't quit. I'll manage you, or I'll sign you and we'll put out a record. And it just kept happening constantly. So it was like one of those things where, like, we just never got put out of our misery. We would be in a coma and then all of a sudden we would be okay and out of the hospital and, you know, running a marathon again. So, you know, the biggest shot we had to actually turn into a band that was going to make a living was in the last couple of years I was in the band, which is why, because people to this day go, well, why did you stay that long? You know, and it's because, well, I stayed until I was sure that it wasn't gonna happen.
Because you never know. Like, the day you quit will be the day that something happens, the day after.
And there's nothing worse than knowing that you spent the prime years of your life in something and then quit like that 1 month too early. And then, like, the new guitar player all of a sudden is playing at Madison Square Garden, you know, and you're like,
it happens a lot, though, man. It happens a lot. Yeah, so that's a legitimate, like, that's a legitimate thing to be afraid of.
So at the end of 2014 is when, like, finally, you know, we had a song that had gone to number 15 on Active Rock.
Okay.
We'd made a little bit of money the summer before, you know, from the radio plays, and we'd been doing some good touring and had, you know, a great investor, you know, we had some investors that had started a label and a management company for us, and put together, they'd basically done what a label would have done. They'd put together a radio team and a publicist and a booking agent. And but as we all know, even if there's nothing done quote unquote wrong, it still doesn't mean that anything's going to happen. You know, just being the right band with the right song at the right time is 90% of it.
That's it.
So
that's
why there's so many bands that, you know, we love as musicians that no one's ever heard of. And then there's a lot of people that are big stars that we think are crap.
Right.
Because an artist also has to connect with a big audience. And sometimes it's just, it's one of those things where they say it's like this intangible thing. It's that last 10% of, like, are you a band that has a song and a look and a style and something intangible that's going to connect with enough of an audience where they're gonna come to your shows and buy your records and whatever. And for most, the answer is no. You know, so when it became clear that we'd given it our best shot and a bunch of stuff was happening within the band also, where it just became clear, like, it's time. You know, it's one time. Of those things where
you see the writing on the wall.
Crystal clear. It's time to go. So then, like I said, that brought us to, you know, end of 2014, and then the year I was home trying to, you know, get some guitar students and whatever.
Yeah.
And then the fateful phone call with Señor Luis.
Yeah, Sir Luis. Well, as we're kind of wrapping up, I want to talk about Dixie Horsepower a little bit. Are you still doing that? Is that
yeah.
That's a cool thing you got going here.
It is. It's awesome because the you know, again, the you know, it was just under the umbrella of Life is Crazy. The cousin I told you about that's 6 years older, he took me to my first concert when I was on my 12th birthday.
Okay.
And it was the David Lee Roth solo tour, if you remember. His first solo tour, Eat 'Em and Smile, when Yankee Rose was out.
Yeah.
So the band is Roth, Steve Vai, Billy Sheehan, and Greg Bissonette.
Yeah, yeah.
So again, talking about having like the back of your head blown off when you're 12.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like sensory overload. You know, I'm just standing there like David Lee Roth, you know, he's jumping off the drum riser and Steve Vai is talking with the guitar and making it laugh and Billy Sheehan is playing solos on a bass and just, I mean, it was just crazy.
Yeah.
So the opening band for that tour was Tesla.
Right. Yeah.
Because they had a really big song on Headbangers Ball called Modern Day Cowboy.
Modern Day Cowboy, yep.
And
I love that.
I came to find out later, and here's where the story ties in. So anyway, the first band I ever saw in an arena was Tesla.
Wow.
So then flash forward, Luis is in Eve to Adam for a couple of years and he plays me some songs and demos from his side project. And he's like, oh, you know who the drummer is? It's Troy Lucchetta from Tesla.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, no shit. That's awesome. And he plays me and it's like these great, like, you know, Southern influence rock songs. And you can totally tell it's Troy playing because he does have a thing. He has a feel.
Yeah,
and a sound.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, this is awesome. You know? So flash forward, I moved to town, and their original guitar player was not in the band anymore. He had moved out of town.
Yeah.
So they were looking, and Luis, you know, graciously recommends me. He was like, hey, you know, my friend Garv just moved to town, and, you know, he played rock, and, you know, he's, you know, we're buddies, and he's like my brother, and this and that. And I ended up hitting it off with the singer and, you know, songwriter Kevin.
Yeah.
And we had, sorry, there's a middle of this story too. After seeing Tesla with David Lee Roth, Eve to Adam had toured with Tesla twice. So I knew Troy.
Oh, so you knew Troy. Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
I knew Troy and he knew who I was loosely.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd become friends with Dave Rude, who's the second guitarist in Tesla. He's a great guitar player and a great dude. So, you know, Troy loosely knew who I was. So Kevin and I started writing, and then they had an EP of material that was great. So I learned that and we started jamming. And the funny part is that they were only a studio band. So the first time we rehearsed together, they had never played the songs before.
Oh, wow.
So it was the first time that Luis had actually played bass and sang the background vocals. And it's the first time that Kevin had played rhythm guitar or whatever.
Yeah.
And the other thing, funny enough, is that I actually sing background vocals too in the band.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because they, you know, for me to do that properly, which I don't know whether I should admit this or not, but for me to do it properly, I need to just, it's like, tell me my part and I'm going to learn my melody, my harmony part, and I'm going to practice it.
Yeah.
And then I can probably do it.
Yeah.
But in Nashville, everyone's so badass that they just hear what the notes, and I've asked you about this before too. Yeah. I've asked Luis about it and I've asked you about it.
Yeah.
Like, what could you do to give me tips on how to sing backgrounds, how to, you know, whatever. So we started writing. We did a few shows already, and the show consists of a couple of originals that we have written, and, you know, there's stuff from their EP.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a couple of really cool shows in December of 2017, and we did a holiday show in Atlanta for one of Kevin's buddy's friends, and we did a few Christmas songs like Hall & Oates and Elvis and all that.
Yeah.
So last October we went into the studio and we recorded three new songs, which I'm really excited about because I co-wrote a couple of them.
Oh, killer.
Okay. Sorry, I co-wrote one of them. One of them was Kevin's song.
Yeah.
And then one like fast kick-ass rocker that Kevin and I co-wrote.
Okay.
And an Elvis Christmas song
that we played the year before. I know that song really well. We used to do that too.
Yeah, exactly. So they actually released that song last Christmas, over Christmas. So there's two more songs. And I'm sure something will be done with them.
Cool.
So sorry, the very long-winded answer to your question
is
that
great.
Yes, it still exists. Kevin lives in Florida now.
Yeah.
But yeah, it exists, and I'm sure we'll do something this year.
You get to play with Troy Lucchetta, the first guy you ever saw play.
Yeah, exactly. So again, you know, coming into the Life is Crazy. So this drummer who played at the first concert I went to, I ended up getting to open up for him on tour, and now I'm actually in a band with him.
Yeah.
And I saw him at the Winery Dog show the other day at the Basement East. And, you know, it's just crazy that this legendary drummer, walks into a room and runs over to me and hugs me and goes, "Hey, I'm in town for 3 weeks. Come over to the house. Let's, you know, let's do a
cookout." That's the beauty of Nashville, is that if you're, you know, if you're lucky, and I've had the experience too, where if you're lucky, some of these people now become your peers and your friends, which is really cool. Well, dude, I'm like, thank you for doing this. Thanks for taking the time to talk. Thanks for moving to Nashville. I'm glad we're friends. I'm glad you're here.
Thanks for convincing me. I've told you, you were one of the factors.
That's good. Well, dude, it's good. I'm glad you're busy. I'm glad you're working.
Yeah.
You know absolutely. What I mean? I'm glad you're doing some cool things, and I'll see you around doing something at some point, somewhere.
Yeah, man. Thanks.
Or I'll just stay here.
Yeah. Yeah. Please.
I'm moving in.
Please do.
Or you can move on to my houseboat.
Yes, please. I would do that in a second. That may be the only reason I'll give up this place.
That's good. Yeah. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. All right, thanks. Man. All right, I hope you enjoyed my chat with my buddy Gaurav. We had a blast that day, in case you couldn't tell. I'm going to post the photo of Gaurav's grandfather with the great Ravi Shankar that we talked about in this episode under the show notes for today's program at tiopod.com, so head on over there and check that out. I'm also going to remind you once again about our Patreon page, because it's very important. It's patreon.com/turnitone. That is patreon.com/turnitone. Please consider becoming a patron of the show to help us keep the lights on over here and the shows coming your way regularly and for free. It would mean the world to me. Do me a favor also and give me a follow on the socials. I'm at Michael J Music on Facebook and Twitter, and also at Michael J Official on Instagram. We also have a new Instagram account for the show at Turn It On Podcast. Look us up in those places and give us follows. If you enjoyed today's episode, I also encourage you to go and check out any one of the previous 54 episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast fix these days. Thanks as always for listening, everybody, and for supporting me and my show. Another episode is coming your way next week, so come on back and check that out, and I will catch you all again soon here on Turn It On.